New Zealand Tech Podcast, the voice of the tech community. Proudly supported by Umbrella Connect.
Greetings and welcome along to the New Zealand Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Spain. Today we have two guests and we're going to be really delving into more on cybersecurity today. Next level from where we were a couple of weeks ago. Great to welcome back Sean Duker, who's joining us remotely from Sydney. How are you, Sean?
Yeah, very good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Maybe a quick intro from you around where you sit in this big world of cybersecurity.
Yeah, so I currently work at Palo Alto Networks as the Regional Chief Security Officer for the Asia-Pacific and Japan region. Been with the company now for a little over 6 years. So my job's really to sort of go out there, work with executives, big and small organizations, and really start to really focus on changing the narrative of what security means. So rather than an executive pointing out, well, we've got one of those boxes, or, you know, we've got a security team that are focused on solving the problem, it's more around, you know, what's their role in it, and how do we sort of help them and guide them around shaping their security strategy for their organization.
That's great. Well, I think guidance is definitely needed in this world at the moment.
Absolutely.
Particularly on this topic. And from Datacom, Matthew Evatts. Great to have you here, Matthew.
Yeah, thanks, Paul.
And maybe a quick intro from you as well, where you fit in. You're reasonably new in the role at Datacom.
Yeah, sure. So I've been here 6 months. I started back in November, and that was part of a change that Datacom made to bring a lot of its cybersecurity capability into a single division across New Zealand. And then we also cover managed security services for Australia and New Zealand as well. So I'm based down in Wellington. We have teams across Auckland, Wellington and Christchurch, and then teams obviously over in Australia as well. And we cover the full range of all things cybersecurity. There's not a lot we don't do. And then we also have a physical security team as well that specializes in surveillance and access control and things like that.
All right, so you really cover a lot of bases then.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. And how have you found that first 6 months? Because well, I was calling it Datacom, you're calling it Datacom. Have I got it right, or have you got it right, or is there or is this a an impossible question to answer?
I think it's impossible. Yeah. It's a bit like whether you spell cybersecurity as two words or one. So I'm going with one, and I think half of Datacom is probably going with two, but it's all fine at the end of the day.
What's your vote on that one, Sean? One or two words for cybersecurity?
One word.
Okay, the experts have spoken, so that's good. Well, look, it's a really interesting time to be delving into this discussion. You know, we've talked over many years on the New Zealand Tech Podcast about cybersecurity related topics from all sorts of angles, but we've never had quite such a star-studded panel, so great to have you here, as we have done over this episode and the one we did a couple of weeks back. So yeah, really great to be able to delve in and I guess take a bit of a step back, look at the broader picture, be strategic about these things. But we are looking at it in the shadow of really a pretty massive cybersecurity incident here in New Zealand, and when we look at what Waikato District Health Board have been having to deal with over the past week or so, it's a really challenging episode that they're having to deal with. Of course, with these matters, there's a fair bit that's kind of kept under wraps, and when you've got bad actors that are there trying to extract money and so on, you're reasonably cautious around what you put out publicly. That's pretty much the norm, isn't it, Matthew?
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, it's important to tell people that something's going on, let people understand that it's being worked on and that it's got the kind of priority that it needs. But then at the same time, you don't want to give either the original threat actor or other bad actors, more information that might help them.
Yeah. Sean, what things immediately jump to your mind when one of these really sort of big, public incidents is made public?
Yeah, look, for me, every time it's more a case of, I think it's just yet another example that we've got an ever-growing, sophisticated adversary that's actually out there, and they're looking for they're actually being opportunistic. They're looking to see how they can extract some data, some dollars, anything of value from a particular organization. I'm kind of in two minds sometimes around the level of information that's actually being shared. I totally appreciate and, you know, respect probably both the comments that were sort of made around that one of, we don't want to give too much away around what the adversary has done or sort of feed, you know, potential sort of other challenges that may sort of arise from any information that's shared. But I also sit there and say, if we're sitting in the shadows and not sharing information, that's also playing to their hand. And the reality is the adversary is going to use and reuse the same techniques and tactics time and time again. So if we're not learning from that and sharing that with others, then it's a simple playbook. They can just go back time and time again to organization A, organization B, organization C without really knowing, how do I defend myself? And yeah, I think that's
agree with
that. And that's the part that I'd love to work out. And not to say that, you know, everything that we've done is wrong, but you turn and go, this is a problem that's ever been, that keeps on growing. So maybe we should actually take stock in the fact that keeping a lot of information to ourselves hasn't really served us that well, and so we should change tack somehow. And maybe we could actually learn from that and, you know, maybe see if we can start to reduce the overall impact that we see.
I think certainly within the industry, we're seeing real benefits from what Sean's talking about, where that information is shared early within the industry, you know, between trusted partners, between vendors and suppliers, like Datacom, Palo Alto, that does pay big dividends, and we are seeing more of that, but we still need to do a lot more of it as well.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point because, you know, I think the general public would assume that, you know, everything's being discussed to a fairly big degree, but realistically, an entity that gets hit, there's a, for better or for worse, there's always that level of embarrassment. You know, could we have, should we have done better? And so, you know, the more you reveal, the more it you know, maybe puts a spotlight on those things that, yeah, in an ideal world, you know, you wouldn't have got hit that way, but yeah, on the flip side, you actually talk about those things, then that helps a whole lot of other people get prepared.
Absolutely. We saw that earlier this year with the Microsoft Exchange vulnerability. Those organizations that got that information early and were able to act early largely got away unscathed. And where there were delays, you know, there was a lot more compromise.
Yeah, yeah. Any thoughts on to add on that one, Sean?
Yeah, look, I think it's a foreseeable event that every organization is going to be targeted. What their success rate is going to be really comes down to how have you looked at cyber as a vector for good and bad things to actually, you know, take place. At the end of the day, it's like any other risk that a business needs to manage. So it really does come down to a question of, you know, when this is going to happen, not if. So how do we actually plan and prepare for that day in advance? I think that's a question that every organization should really be asking themselves. And I totally get and appreciate the fact that, you know, some people want to see this as sensitive. It might be embarrassing. Absolutely. But we've got to learn from something. You know, I think the biggest thing that I've seen time and time again is when people, you know, over embellish maybe a story on, you know, it's been a nation state that's attacked us. Okay. Why would a nation state attack you, for number one? Number two, how do you know that a nation state's hit you when you've only found out about the breach a day or 2 days earlier? You know, I think about a lot of the investigations that have taken place. It takes months, many, many months, to actually sort of work out who may have actually had something to do with it, and let alone, you know, half the time, attribution is a very hard game because sometimes it can be a bit of a distraction. So let's focus on the issue at hand, which is, what was the problem? How did they get in? How do we close that gap? Is there a new novel technique that's actually being used? Let's actually share, disseminate that with everyone else. Because guess what? That forces the hand of the adversary to go back to the drawing board and think of a better way to actually try and launch an attack. And I'd rather make them work a little bit harder every single time as opposed to make it easier.
100%. I love it. It's a really, really good, approach. Now, having really sort of walked through a lot of the COVID journey here in Australia, New Zealand, of course, you know, other countries dealing with it as well, and maybe, you know, that journey is going to diverge a little bit in terms of how, you know, how things get back to a level of normality down under compared to other markets, depending on vaccines, depending on, you know, opening up of borders and so on. But we've seen some changes really from a cyber perspective in that we've had so many more people working remotely than, I mean, it's just complete transformation really for a lot of businesses. and so many organisations that I've talked to in the technology space, just talking about, man, we're doing crazy numbers. We're offering so many services. We're selling in all sorts of new things that we weren't selling prior to COVID. We've done all this digital transformation. Now, I tend to look at those things and think, well, you probably should have actually, those things should have been done ahead of COVID anyway, arguably. But if it took COVID to get the transformation, then, you know, that's good. And often, you know, often it takes something, right, to stir up that change. So, you know, we are dealing with a different landscape, you know, networks. And I, you know, think of my own little firm where, you know, we were supporting a handful of networks, and you know, suddenly you multiply that out based on every home network that you're, you know, suddenly technically is part of what you have to deal with and help protect. So I'm keen to delve into you know, a little bit of the changes that's led to. And when we look at cybersecurity, we've had this ongoing resourcing challenge. I think it's, you know, it's fair to say it's been continuing. And then we dropped COVID into the mix, and we now have a nation whose, you know, borders are you know, predominantly closed. Looking at New Zealand, very similar for Australia. I think a little bit different in terms of maybe some of the visas and so on that have been granted on the Australian side, able to see quite a popularity in terms of visas on that side on a tech front. But of course, the borders have been such that not that many people are able to get in both cases. So yeah, I'm kind of keen to hear some perspectives on this. Maybe, you know, Matthew, you know, how's that looked for Datacom, for your customers? What are the learnings? How do we keep going if there aren't enough people available?
Yeah, I think maybe to just talk to your first point there for a second, in that you know, what COVID did is really just accelerate a conversation that, you know, the industry was already having with customers about, hey, it's no longer enough to have a perimeter. You know, there was the discussion around defence and depth and protecting your endpoints and all that. It had been a discussion that had been happening for many years. What COVID has done, I think, has really moved the discussion along a lot more quickly, and it's moved it into a space where it's much more about our identity and how we identify devices and people, and how we actually use data, and much less about, you know, how do we ring fence things. And that's still important, but it's, you know, we really have a very distributed infrastructure, if that's what you want to call it now, and we've got a big task ahead of us to actually secure that. And obviously that then plays into the people question, because if you're then people constrained and your job is even bigger than it used to be, then that's a real challenge. So we've been doing a number of things. I mean, I think previously the whole tech industry in New Zealand had really benefited from New Zealand being quite an attractive place to come and live, and so we had attracted a lot of talent in over the borders, and I think that will happen again once the borders open. But it has reminded us that it's also really important to grow talent, and so we're doing a lot of work in that space, and not just in cyber but more widely as well, working with the local education institutes, working with iwi as well, trying to ensure that people know about the right pathways, that they're going into those pathways. So we're seeing some really encouraging success in that area, in Unitech up here, and in ARA down in the South Island. We've got some great cyber diploma programs and things that are bringing people straight into the industry, so that's really cool to see. And we've got a lot of interns out of those programs already sitting within Datacom learning some great new skills. So at the moment, 15% of my headcount in cyber is just interns, which we're super excited about.
That's huge.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Really good.
I did the count a few days ago, and I was like, wow, that's 15%. And look, would like to see that grow too. You know, obviously there's an overhead for having those people in the room, but we want them in the room. We want more of them. And also graduates. You know, we're employing as many graduates as we can. And in fact, Unitech is currently producing more graduates than their current partners can employ in the cyberspace, and so I've already reached out to my wider industry contacts and said, hey, look, you know, we've got some graduates here, are you interested in coming along on this journey? And they are, and so I think that's an example, going back to Sean's earlier point about sharing information around how the industry can work together to actually you know, protect the wider country and globe. You know, let's actually work together to bring these people into cybersecurity.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I remember talking to Mark Rees at Xero some weeks back, and we sort of delved into being referred to as the brain gain or the reverse brain drain, and that, you know, we have that advantage. And I know Australia has seen a similar thing, you know, where people sort of coming back from overseas during COVID. A lot of Kiwis that have come home. Have you seen that in the cybersecurity area? Anything sort of noticeable from that perspective?
Not really in my division specifically. Potentially in the wider Datacom, I couldn't speak to that. I think what we have seen is that it's certainly a very tight market because those borders are closed. But what I think it has created is that it's people have had a bit of a sit down and had to think about where they want to go to next. And so what we have seen is a willingness to retrain into the industry. And so a lot of those interns and graduates I was talking about, they're not necessarily straight out of school or out of university. They've already had careers for several years or even many years, and then they've thought, actually, that looks like a really interesting place to be. Let's retrain and go into that. And so I think that has been a benefit. So although we might not have benefited from people coming back, I think we've benefited from the fact that people have actually had a rethink about where they're going and looked at what's out there and made some decisions based on that.
Yeah. Any comments there, Sean?
Yeah, look, I think it's an interesting one, just the whole sort of realm of what we sort of really have experienced the last 15 months. And I think it's going to keep on sort of evolving and changing. I think this dependency on people flying into the country to really sort of complement, augment sort of the workforce that we've got, I think it's going to be something that will continue to be challenged for some time. And I'm the eternal optimist, so I'm not trying to say that the pandemic's going to continue for too long. I prefer it wouldn't. But I think it's just going to be one of those things that we need to start thinking about, you know, what are some of those different models that are out there? And I loved what some of the points were that Matt was sort of going through. But I think as we continue to sort of evolve and go through all of this, we need to start looking at what are some other ways? How do I complement the work that my security team are doing? You know, a managed security services, something that, you know, more organizations should really be taking up. And it's really around, how do we just change that paradigm? If it's so let's just call it the warm bodies that are sort of coming to the office and sort of doing those things, kind of also challenge that notion as well, because that's where you get that challenge where we've got a cybersecurity skill shortage. And, you know, again, sometimes that's an interesting point, because if we train 7 billion people on the planet to be cybersecurity professionals, we probably would still lose. And the reason I say that is, what are we actually training them on? And throwing people into kind of a machine fight, I think we're going to be losing, because the adversary is using, you know, and automating their tools to launch attacks against us. We need to be using automation as well. So how do we start to think about a different way to solve some of these problems?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely key. And, you know, we do, you know, talk a lot about automation and artificial intelligence and it taking jobs away. But when you look at it and, you know, varying concepts, varying areas in cybersecurity, you know, I think it's just an absolutely perfect example where what we are trying to do to defend our organisations, our country, you know, these things can't be done by just people, right? And Of course the attackers will be using, you know, whatever they can get their hands on in terms of, you know, automation, artificial intelligence, any smart things they can come up with. And, you know, if that's not happening on the defense side, then the results are going to be fairly predictable, I would have thought.
Absolutely. I think Sean touched on an important point there before too, where you know, these attackers can reuse whatever they've come up with across lots of potential targets, and it's really profitable for them. So of course they're going to invest whatever they need to up front in order to be able to make the tech, and then they're going to reuse it. And in some respects we have to take the same approach on the defence side, where we need to be able to defend lots of organisations using the same capability, and that's certainly what we're trying to achieve within the managed security space, is being able to leverage the same group of people and tool sets and capabilities and processes across lots of customers and really drive that efficiency. But also, you know, again to Sean's point around automation and AI and you know, not just trying to throw people at it all the time, that is so important. You know, one of the big investments that we're making in this financial year is more in that AI and automation space for cybersecurity. And look, as far as we can see, that's going to carry on for a number of years yet, that will be a huge play for us.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely essential, and the resourcing issue in terms of people just really, you know, shines that extra, you know, light on it. And the idea of, you know, organisations necessarily trying to do all of these things internally versus using a managed security provider, I don't know. I mean, in the early years of my career, there was a window there where I worked internally within an organisation doing IT, and which was a break for me from having worked serving a whole lot of organisations, and what I quickly recognised was boring. I'm getting only access to seeing what goes on in one or two organisations. And my skills were going to go stale if I just, stayed with that very, very, very small, tight, client base. And, I recognise that if you're going to stay on the cutting edge and stay current in technology as somebody that works in the space, you need to be looking across and involved with lots and lots of organisations. And I think, the reverse applies to, certainly in cybersecurity, and I know there are cases where it does, it works well for organisations having internal teams and resources and so on, but cybersecurity, probably more than any other area I can think of, you need people that have the experience of, what happens when something goes wrong, what are the absolute best practice mechanisms, tools and technologies that you can use and use them across a broad set, rather than I'm just kind of learning because my company's just bought this tool and I'm the guy or the gal that's been tasked with figuring it out and applying that technology. I'm sure we've got some listeners that may be uncomfortable with what I'm saying, but I think there's a lot to be said for maybe rethinking how we do some of these things.
I think it's a really big ask for any internal cybersecurity team to do it all by themselves. So even if an organisation chooses to have an internal team, they're almost always going to need augmentation because there's just such a lot to get across. It's a lot of training to do, and which you touched on as well. But we also talked earlier about that need for information sharing, and to do that within a small team, a single organisation, is tough. I mean, we ingest an enormous amount of telemetry and then reuse that across lots of organisations. And, our partners like Palo Alto help us do that, but we have to use multiple partners in order to get that level of telemetry required. So I think, it is a really big ask. My kind of rough rule of thumb is that if you're an organisation of anything less than 10,000 seats, then you're really pushing it uphill to try and run security internally. And even those organisations that are over 10,000 seats, it's still a big ask to be doing it alone.
Yeah, I could ask all sorts of questions around what state for organisations that have been hit, but maybe not particularly sort of helpful to delve into that. But I guess my general feeling is, as a country, as a region, maybe this is just the same everywhere. Our standard is too low from a cybersecurity perspective within most organisations. And that we do need to step up, and I guess people have got these messages around COVID, but they realise the importance because they know that their lives are at risk. But have we kind of got that broader message about cybersecurity? I mean, we haven't had government messages on TV and things just pushed at us. So, can we change that, Sean? Is there an opportunity to lift that bar in a manner, that's more widespread than what's been happening at the moment, to kind of, lift the overall, what's the term, cyber wellness, I've heard said, to be in a much more robust position.
Yeah, look, I think absolutely there is an opportunity. And I think the opportunity is there for us every single day to actually sort of grab hold of it. I think a big mentality that we actually just have to change, or just really sort of a mindset, is just do something different. And I'd kind of would question one sort of key thing. And I'm not just saying that we've actually done something wrong, but for the last, let's just say 30 years, dealing with cybersecurity challenges and risks to an organization, would you really put hand on heart and say that we've actually nailed it? We've absolutely smashed it. And I'd probably say, no, we haven't. So I think a lot of the times when we talk about sort of that skill shortage and what we need to do and sort of do things differently, I think it also means, let's also start with a couple of key things. Let's stop looking for the unicorn, because that person that has 25 different certifications, 10 years experience, you know, must be security cleared with government organizations and the like, and you're going to pay them, you know, let's just say $50,000 a year. That doesn't exist. So let's stop looking for that person. Let's also stop looking in the same well. Because we tend to keep on looking for people that are, they're working one organization today doing security, let's grab them, poach them, they're getting poached with someone else. So we just keep on looking for the same people all the time. Keep on looking at the same people. I think what we need to do is, let's just go find the people that are problem solvers by nature. They're curious. They've got the curious minds. Let's teach them security. I think one of the big things that we probably have been struggling for years is we keep on seeing security as a technology problem. And it's a lot more than that. It's a broader problem. So I think we need to even have people that are translators, you know, someone that can convert technical to business, business to technical. These are not really things that are taught that often. And there's not that many people that are great at it or many people that are out there. So I think we just need to start thinking about what is the problem that we believe we're going to see for the next 30 years, as opposed to using the playbook of, well, if that's what we saw the last 30, more than likely we're going to see that again exponentially. And that's where I just challenge the notion of let's do something different, because I think we could actually solve this problem collectively, but it starts with you. It starts with every other person that's out there, and we just have to start to, you know, create that momentum slowly, slowly.
Matthew, you've got thoughts on how we change tech and, you know, do better at the education and then, you know, ultimately the results at the other end?
I think Sean's point about just doing something different really resonates, and one of the reasons for that is because a lot of what we see in organisations that have either already been breached or are really struggling to lift their maturity is that their biggest hurdle is a cultural change, and it's about treating risk differently, you know, especially around information risk and privacy risk. You know, we saw that change in Australia and New Zealand around health and safety. It took a long time, but you know, we got together, we did the work, there was the right legislation put in place. Someone argue went too far. But at the end of the day, we're in a much better place health and safety wise than we were 3-4 decades ago, and we need that similar kind of cultural shift with cyber. I think we're starting to see it. We're starting to see a bit more visibility at board level. It's been taken more seriously, the investment in cyber has grown, but there's a lot more cultural change that needs to happen. And I think what's particularly disappointing is that we still see a lot of the basics not done right. And you know, if we could just do the basics better, we would be in a much better place than what we are now.
I think, you know, anybody that's kind of, you know, looked, you know, across a reasonable number of New Zealand organisations and look at the, you know, the state we're in would, you know, definitely have seen that, yeah, basics are often, you know, really, really, really not looked at. And, yeah, I don't know how you necessarily can address that at pace other than when we get these big incidents that, you know, that help those who are trying to bring the change, you know, get the message across. So there is a flip side to the bad things that happen, in that it does help bring about that change. What about at you know, we talked a little bit about governance at the board level, and that it's, you know, these things are starting to get taken a bit more seriously at that level, but there certainly doesn't seem to be any legislation within New Zealand that's sort of got any teeth that says, hey, if as a director of this firm, you don't care about this stuff and XYZ sort of happens and you're going to be held accountable. Yet we look to, say, Europe with their general data protection regulations, GDPR, and, you know, there's quite hefty sort of fines on the organisations and, you know, I think on the individuals as well, where they have, you know, they have issues. And, you know, there's been some reasonably large sort of fines handed down. And there is, I think, you know, there's a real interconnection between these two, because you have a cyber incident, and particularly when an organisation says, I'm not paying the ransom, and in current world we're in, if you don't pay a ransom, then there's a very high likelihood that data is actually going to get leaked. But we certainly don't have any sort of any teeth locally within New Zealand anyway, legally, that sort of you know, really has directors thinking, boy, I better do something about this. We have it in health and safety where lives are at stake. But this has a big flow on. If we don't get cybersecurity right, then it impacts our overall economy. It impacts, you know, the flow on from that in terms of, you know, we can either fix poverty or we can go backwards. All of these things potentially are interconnected. So should we do something more on that front?
I think we absolutely should. I think it is a mixture of the carrot and the stick, though. I mean, the recent change to the privacy legislation was encouraging, but as you pointed out, it doesn't really have a lot of teeth. You know, maximum fine of $10,000. A couple of years beforehand, Australia made their legislative change. I'm sure you might be able to correct me here, but I think it's $100,000. So that's, you know, that's a big difference. And $100,000 looks a lot bigger figure when it's written on a piece of paper as well. So we do need a bit more of the stick, and not just externally to the organisations, but internally as well. You know, what are the consequences within an organisation of actually doing things poorly, like missing a patch cycle or missing two or three patch cycles, which is what we often see. But I think there's a lot more understanding of the carrot that's needed too, and that's the real value of doing cyber right, you know, not losing your intellectual property out of an organisation, being able to move faster without the fear of things getting leaked or falling over, you know, being ahead of your competition in a competitive market, being able to attract the right kind of staff, you know, looking good in the press. There's lots of value that we can get out of cyber, and so I think there's a bigger discussion around that needs to happen as well.
That's a great point, because if you're stuck on sort of old systems, old technology, the way that impacts and allows you to operate as a business or any sort of organisation, it's, you know, it's like carrying a big dead weight for the organisation. And so, you go through the right sort of digital transformation processes that, you know, include thinking around cyber, and there's all sorts of wins. And it, you know, I guess, yeah, ultimately has a big win from a financial perspective and all those other sort of flow-ons when your organisation's in a great place. I love that perspective. Yeah. Sean, have you given some thought to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely agree. I think it's definitely something that's key. But, you know, let's be clear that if we don't take the time to actually pay down our technology debt, at some point in time it's going to be a very big payback that we have to sort of give. So, you know, to make those, you know, slow and steady strides to actually make the change happen, you have to be doing that. You know, we can't turn around and say, oh, you know, this has been a bit of a harder year, let's spend less on, you know, security or technology or something like that. We've got to be a little bit pragmatic as well. And if you think about just the shift alone at the start of the pandemic, you know, people en masse started to move out to public cloud infrastructures because they just wanted to find a better way to, you know, to keep on selling their products and services and digitize, you know, a lot of the work they were doing. You know, fast forward the first 10 months of the pandemic, we saw the greatest amount of, or the greatest influx of movement to public cloud than we'd seen in the previous 10 years. So just those numbers alone are just staggering when you start to stop and think about it. So I think that's a key thing. In terms of, you know, when regulation is not around, be prepared because it's going to be coming around the corner. I'm not trying to say that, you know, we must have the stick and the stick needs to sort of come whacking out people or anything like that. But the reality is we've actually seen that some people probably haven't spent the time to actually, you know, correct some of the challenges that they've actually got inside their own organization. If you think about where we've also seen, you know, how that the attacks have also shifted and changed somewhat as well. If you've got any type of operational technology that's inside your own organization, so think of critical infrastructure, or think if you're running like an energy sector or some sort of utility plant. The reality is if you've got some sort of cyber attack that takes place, that has a physical implication as well. You could literally start to, you're risking lives at that point. And are we trying to say that a law needs to come out that reflects totally on cyber? Or to your point, you know, that's part of the occupational health and safety challenges. Those lines are getting more and more blurred every single time. So the time to act is now, because we are more interconnected than we've ever been before. We will continue to go down that path. So I think we just need to keep thinking about it, that this is something that as we propel our businesses forward and work out what's the better way and the place that we want to get to, how are we de-risking that process every single time?
Yeah, that's good. Now, Sean, maybe just if we've got any listeners that don't understand what technology debt or technical debt is, can you maybe just delve into an explanation there?
Yeah, so a good example of technology that is, I use a piece of technology today, and you know, software is software. There's always going to be some sort of vulnerability or a challenge or a bug that's popped up. So I need to constantly keep on doing that maintenance. And that means like rolling out patches and the like. And if I'm not using the latest and greatest technology, if I'm not applying the maintenance updates that are actually there, I'm kind of always going to be sitting behind, you know, multiple versions, multiple patches. And that just creates a further exposure to your own organization. You know, I still hear it today that some people are using Windows XP as an example, and you think that's been around for 20 plus years and is probably completely riddled with vulnerabilities. There are no longer any patches that are out there. That is the biggest exposure you could have. And because you haven't decided to make the inroads and say, let's actually move away from XP, I've got this massive debt. And at some point in time, because I now need to leapfrog so many different versions, it's probably going to cost me a lot more to do that. It's like going for your service and thinking, I need to change my brake pads, and all of a sudden you find out that you've got some transmission problems and you're missing a tire or something like that. You know, the more that we start to do those maintenance, the more that we can start to work out and prevent that bigger problem up ahead in the future.
Great. Excellent explanation. Now, I've got some stats here that kind of, they won't necessarily surprise everybody, but they are sort of shocking in their own way. These are from Forrester. 31% of employees still admit to going around security policies. 53% say that their leadership team has not made security a social norm. We've got 51% state that they have better things to do than attend the appropriate education sessions when it comes to cybersecurity. So we have some real, you know, challenges there in terms of getting everybody on board and on the same page and, you know, thinking about this stuff day to day. How do we address that? Is there an answer?
I don't think there's one answer. It's a real challenge, and it is something that we struggle with all the time. You know, it's something that we work with our customers to resolve. And obviously, there's a technology side to help this problem, and then there's the people side. I think it does need a lot more focus within organisations, and it comes back to that cultural change that we were talking about before, and also that mixture of carrot and stick. I think if organisations are really serious about it, they do need to ensure their staff understand why it's important. But there also needs to be some consequences. You know, if you're a repeat offender, either not doing the training or repeatedly failing the phishing test when it's sent out, then there needs to be some consequences to that. And very few organisations have that in place. And I think we would start to see change happen quite rapidly if that was coming down from the leadership right throughout the organisation.
So on that front, what do you do at Datacom? If somebody clicks twice, have you got a solution to this one?
Yeah, so we have a discussion with those people. So they literally get a phone call or a visit to the desk if they click once, actually.
Yeah.
And we're testing our staff all the time. So we send out phishing tests. Some of them are actually very good. I had to read one twice recently before I realised it was a test. But that is exactly the kind of thing that every organisation needs to be doing. And look, we can all do better. I'm certainly not saying that we're perfect, but the staff people involved have to know that that either they've not passed the test and they need to do some more training, or that there are consequences, or at least at the very least understand why we do this. You know, why is it important? Because often I think that piece is missing.
Yeah, no, you're dead right. Sean, any tricks or sticks that you've seen in regards to the training?
Yeah, look, I think organisations that are leveraging gamification are definitely ones that are, thinking about it a little bit differently. Because I think the approach is, you know, think about security awareness training as typically being, you know, we've got to do the annual compliance, tick in the box, you know, just hit next 10 times and all of a sudden you're cyber compliant, so to speak, for your organization. Doesn't really solve anything. So I think this is where definitely needs to be a top-down approach. Organizations need to really be setting the tone from the leadership level down. And the reason for that is we look up to our leaders. And if they're not, you know, practicing, you know, how to actually be that... as the cyber safe employee, then, you know, people are going to follow suit and just go, well, if they don't do it, why am I going to do it? So I think we need to sort of call that one out. I think the other thing is, let's actually reward success. It's actually a good thing when people turn around and go, I think I've actually done something wrong. You know, so take the example of the phishing test. you know, you want people to turn around and go and make a little bit of a healthy rivalry. You don't have to single out individuals. Obviously, your manager could do that directly, but create that sort of departmental healthy rivalry to say, you know, this time around, the marketing team were number one. No one clicked on it, or, you know, this particular group here, the product managers, well, they were the ones that clicked on it within the first 15 seconds. You know, let's learn from that. And pretty quickly, you start to see different patterns of behavior. You know, I've got the privilege of actually seeing and having oversight to our own internal security program. And I love seeing the email that comes out at 5 o'clock in the morning that's actually testing people. Because what's the first thing you do when you grab your phone in the morning? First thing you do in the morning, grab your phone. People are half asleep. They're clicking on an email. They're clicking on a link. And all of a sudden, it's like, we've got you. You know, and that's the thing. We just want to try and change that behavior. Is it the only thing you can do? No. So we need to think about, again, people, process, and technology. And let's keep on sort of shifting the balance every single time. But make it fun. Make it enjoyable.
Love it, love it.
Such a good point. Yeah, I think that gamification really helps. You know, I've seen a couple of organizations do that kind of leaderboard type approach, and great idea. We should definitely do more of that.
Yep. That's cool. Now, I want to change tack. I've got some stats to do with our cloud workloads, right? And COVID has been this time, as was raised, where a whole lot of things have been moved to the cloud. And, you know, generally for very, very good reasons to do this. But I've got these stats that I wanted to cover off. Apparently, 70% of organizations hosting data or workloads in the public cloud have experienced a security incident. I don't think that's too much of a surprise to most of us because, look, you know, everybody gets targeted and at some point in time, everybody gets hit. But when you actually hear the numbers, it does actually sort of slap you in the face a little bit. 44% of organizations stated that data loss or leakage was one of their top three security concerns. And two-thirds of organizations apparently leave back doors open to attackers through misconfigured cloud services. That is a really, really high figure. But I think it just does reflect that this stuff is not easy to do. And that the pace in which organizations move today means there are new things being fired up, you know, in the public cloud all the time. So inevitably, if you're not cautious enough and you don't have the right mechanisms in place, then you're going to be leaving some things wide open. So, you know, it seems really clear that, you know, protecting what we put in the cloud really needs some effort. In terms of, you know, making sure that we address these risks that we've talked about. Sean, I'm keen to hear from you in terms of how does Palo Alto as a security vendor basically look at these sorts of challenges and then build into your roadmap to, you know, to help organizations out? How do you make sure that you're helping people with these challenges?
Yeah, look, absolutely. And probably just to add another statistic to sort of, you know, the round out the why we sort of do what we do. You know, I think that to a large extent, many people still believe that there's kind of a blurred line between what's their responsibility versus what's the responsibility of the cloud service provider. And there really is a shared responsibility, you know, and the best way to think about it is anything you put into the cloud, you need to protect it. The service provider is really going to think about protecting their own infrastructure, the platform they're actually using. So there's a number of different capabilities that are really needed when you're actually sort of moving out to public cloud. And that could be something like the traditional lift and shift, what we saw at the start. So people building applications out in the cloud, leveraging containers, leveraging infrastructure as code, making it and really sort of using that sort of automation piece and the elasticity that the cloud really sort of offers. But at every single point, we need to go off and buy technology to actually help us achieve that. So you think about that continuous improvement, continuous development pipeline that's actually there. We need to ensure that we're putting security early on into that build process and not just simply relying at the end. Once I've created the application and it's running, great, turn it on and put the security on. When you think about it, how do we actually stop these problems before they become an issue? So as a company over the last number of years, we've really started to build out a capability where we said, we're going to go out and buy the best technology that's actually out on the market right now. Because lo and behold, you will actually need to buy all these different types of capabilities. But the challenge that we've actually seen for the number of years with security is as an industry, we've actually forced organizations to become the plumbers. They have to grab all these different solutions and try and work out how they, you know, jimmy them all together and try and sort of get the solutions to work inside their own environment. So we said, let's take that problem away. So we basically built a platform using technologies that we had acquired through organic growth as well. And we started to build out the platform where you say, from cradle to grave, when you're going through your maturity process out in public cloud, irrespective of what cloud it is. So multi-cloud purpose, where every organization is really multi-cloud and hybrid, let's actually secure everything. So make it uniformed in terms of what the security looks like, have the ability that you can mature along the process without needing to buy extra technologies every single time, but at the same time, give you that same look and feel. So whether you're using Google's GCP platform or AWS or Azure, you can simply say, this is the way that I want to roll out security and make it uniformed and make it consistent across the board, because consistency or lack of consistency is the part that ends up killing most security programs, because they're just not got eyes on screen. They can't really see what's going on. And that's how we try and solve the problem of thinking about, where is the problem today? Where do we think it's going to go? And right now, I'd say that many times people are over provisioning access to different systems they've actually got out there. They're not changing that. They're not revoking the privileges that have actually been granted. And that's where a cyber attacker comes and says, great, thank you. I've just now compromised your account, Paul, and I've got access to the keys to the kingdom.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And it's not easy to take the other approach, is it? Which is to, you know, completely limit access and give it exactly where you need it. But it is the right approach. And the default often is kind of upside down from that perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, with the cloud having grown so quickly, there's still that, I think, a mismatch in understanding, which Sean touched on, around, hey, we can do this stuff and we can do it securely. The reality is that so much of what's out there is not configured well, and that's where a lot of those stats that you've touched on, Paul, come from, is poorly configured cloud. And but even when we do have well-configured cloud, we still need that safety net. So we need the good hygiene, we need the good process around setting up privileged accounts and all that kind of thing, and we need the tools in place with trained people, you know, watching and using those tools, and all of those have to be working together to actually secure the cloud. And in many cases, none of them are happening. And so, you know, there's lots of holes in that.
Yeah. Sean, you know, for Palo Alto, there's sort of that history of a lot of acquisitions, which seems to be, you know, quite a, you know, a key part of just the way things work today, to get, you know, you get the best and brightest as you acquire those that are starting up new firms. But, you know, we've seen, I guess, some, you know, technology companies that do these acquisitions, but it takes, you know, years for them to really kind of, you know, join up the dots and get that working together. And then sometimes it's a complete failure anyway. How has that side of things sort of been playing out for Palo Alto from what you've seen over the last few years?
Yeah, look, totally agree on the perspective and observation of how other organizations have done it. I think what makes us different and set us apart is the fact that, you know, for 16 years now as a company, we've really fundamentally believed in how do we create a natively integrated platform that can fundamentally solve and collapse a number of these different security services that are actually needed out there. So if I think about what we've done with public cloud, we went out and acquired a company called Evident.io, which was really focused on doing kind of that audit compliance on AWS. But again, it was just AWS as the cloud service provider. We then went and acquired a company called Redlock, which was really focused on doing this multi-cloud, so looking at GCP, AWS, and Azure. Within 40 days, we basically ported over everything that was in Evident into the Redlock platform, and in turn, turned that into our Prisma Cloud offering that we've actually got today. We then went out and acquired capability, which is called TwistLock, and PureSec, which are focused on container security and serverless security. And again, it took us 3 months to port that capability over into that platform. And from there, we've acquired more and more technology. So for us, what you probably can see there is we're not sitting on our hands at all during this process. We're actively saying, let's actually work out what are the bits of code that we need. How do we ensure that we're not just simply jamming some sort of Frankenstein-like solution together, but really working out how do we get the efficiencies, the gains that are actually there? And if there's overlap, great. What are the cool pieces that we actually need? What complements what we've already got today? We acquired, most recent acquisition that we acquired was a company called Bridge Crew, which is focused on infrastructure as code. So really working closely with the DevOps team, inserting ourselves early on to that sort of build process. We've already got some of that capability, but we just said, great, let's actually complement that. Let's augment it and turn it into something that's even better. And I think as we see, cloud is just constantly keeps on changing all the time. You know, cloud service providers are coming out with brand new APIs all the time. There's brand new ways that people think about moving from APIs to microservices. The containers are being leveraged a lot more than, you know, the lift and shift approach. We're just seeing this natural change that's constantly happening out there. So for us, it's all about innovating, constantly keep on putting new capabilities there at the fingertips of our customers, and just really giving them that, you know, that kind of one central place they can go to, and they've got all this extra capability that's there each and every time. So for us, we're not sitting back and sort of waiting for, you know, build it and they will come. It's all about build it, and we're going to keep on sort of reinventing ourselves and challenging ourselves and challenging what status quo really means every time.
Good. That's actually pretty good story you got there, Sean.
Yeah,
that's cool. Well, maybe we'll leave the final word with Matthew. We're sort of, you know, coming to an end, but yeah, any final thoughts that you wanted to share?
Probably all I'd say is that I've got a huge amount of optimism for this industry. So I think a lot of the times we hear the kind of FUD, fear, uncertainty, doubt. And yes, there's some bad stuff happening out there. And yes, there's a lot of catching up to do, which we've touched on. But I think if we start to approach this differently, we make an ongoing investment in how we protect our organizations, we work together. More like Sean was saying earlier, you know, we can make some really impressive advances. And we've started to see that happen already, but, you know, we need to make some further big leaps. And I think we can absolutely do that. So let's get on with the job. You know, we want to work with New Zealand and Australian organisations and help them make those leaps forward.
Excellent. Well, thanks everyone for joining us this week on the New Zealand Tech Podcast. It's been great to have you on the show and listening in. A big thank you to Matthew and to Sean. Really, really appreciated your expertise. And yeah, you've certainly got a lot there. And I thought we've hopefully covered the best points that'll fill in some good gaps for our listeners. So yeah, really appreciate that. Thank you to our show partners. Thank you to Umbrella Connect, Datacom and Palo Alto, Vodafone, Vocus, Spark, and HP. Really appreciate all of these organizations that stand behind the New Zealand Tech Podcast and behind the technology and innovation ecosystems here in New Zealand and help us get the word out. So, yeah, much appreciated, and we'll look forward to catching everybody on the next episode.
Cheers, Paul.
Cheers.
Thanks, Paul.
New Zealand Tech Podcast, the voice of the tech community, proudly supported by Umbrella Connect.